saw the beginnings of the Reformation in Geneva the last time, and then we glanced forward to Calvin's relation to it. Now this morning we will start Capital D, the early life and education of John Calvin. Number one, his parentage and youth. We find in his parentage a remarkable similarity to that of Luther. Both of them, their grandfathers were peasants. In both cases, their fathers were men who, by hard work and careful toil, had raised themselves out from the poverty which had characterized their ancestors for many generations and had won a rather secure position in life. In Luther's case, Luther was well along in his life before his father reached that point. In Calvin's case, the father was already fairly well established by the time that Calvin was born in 1509. And so his father was able to get certain privileges for Calvin that Luther's father was unable to get for him. He got him a good elementary education and was able to get him trained with the sons of the nobility in the area where he was born, which gave him certain advantages of knowing how to deal with people of various classes that were useful all his life. Number two, education. After getting what education could be secured at the town where he was born, the town of Noyon, N-O-Y-O-N, about 60 miles north of Paris, his father sent him to Paris. And there in Paris, he had a very good, solid education. His father had intended that the boy should go into the priesthood and had secured him certain privileges with that in mind at Noyon from the bishop there. But now the father had some disagreement with the local clergy in Noyon and decided there'd be greater future for his son-in-law anyway. Here again we find the similarity. Martin Luther's father urged him to go into law, felt he would make a great name for himself in law. But Luther only had a few months of law before he left and went into the monastery. Calvin went to the city of Orleans in southern France, and there, the town after which our New Orleans is named in this country, of course. And there he secured a very good education in law. He showed such remarkable brain in law that when his professors were away, they used to ask him to lecture to the class. And he completed his law education, and just about that time, his father died. And when his father died, Calvin felt free to do what he was interested in rather than what his father had wanted. Luther had gone against his father's wishes in going into the monastery. In Calvin's case, Calvin followed his father's wishes as long as his father lived. But though he had a good training in law, he was much more interested in literature. And so he decided to go back to Paris and to continue the study of classics, in which he had made a good start in his undergraduate education before he went to Orleans. Number three, conversion. We do not have the specific details about Calvin's conversion that we do about Luther. We actually know comparatively little about it. In fact, all we do know is a few references in some of his writings. But in these references, it's made very clear that he considered that his conversion had been a tremendous change in his life. He felt as if a power much superior to himself had taken a hold of him and turned his life around and changed his interest, which formerly had been very little in religion, to now a tremendous interest in the Bible and in knowing what God's will was. He felt that he had become conscious of his sin and of his need of a Savior and had seen that in Christ alone through simple faith could his salvation be found. Now, as I say, we do not have an account at the time. We have later references, incidental references, by Calvin to his conversion, but enough to show that it was a tremendous experience which affected his whole life. Yes? No, he doesn't. No particular text. In fact, he doesn't give us any one lengthy account of it, but he just incidentally refers to it in two or three different places in his writings. That's number three, then, his conversion. Number four, Calvin's first writing. It would seem that perhaps he had already started this, his first, the first work he prepared for publication before his conversion, and he continued with it and published it. And whether it was affected by his conversion or not is hard to say. There's some who try to make out it was purely a humanistic work. The word humanistic in that time, when we refer to those days, means something entirely different from today, you know. Today, a humanist is one who denies the supernatural, one who puts man at the center of the universe. In those days, a humanist was one who was interested in the finest productions of the human spirit, in other words, in the writings of ancient Greece and Rome, and was interested in that great literature which had become available in the previous decades to the modern world. So the word means entirely different when we speak of a humanist then and a humanist today. Calvin had great interest in this humanism, that is to say, in the great advances of the human spirit in ancient times. Great interest in that before he was converted, yes? His first book was a commentary on a writing by the philosopher Seneca, S-E-N-E-C-A. Seneca wrote a work which was called On Clemency. On Clemency. And Calvin wrote a commentary on it. And in this commentary, he discusses the background of it and its general import, its references to various ancient writers, discusses the meaning of various words and so on. It's a great work of erudition, the sort of thing that a classical scholar might have written and some interpreted simply as a great work on the, in the study of classics. But there are others who point out the subject is clemency, and Calvin was greatly interested in the King of France being more tolerant of the Protestants and not punishing them for their departure from the medieval church, and that in the course of this work, there's constant emphasis by Seneca on a high standard of ethics and morals, and that they think that maybe it was greatly affected by his conversion. Now, you can't prove it. You can make a good argument in either case. But it was a good, solid work of erudition. Incidentally, this man, Seneca, had been the tutor to Nero. When Nero was a young man, Seneca was his tutor, and he had a certain influence on Nero in moderating some of his wickedness, although I'm afraid not very much. But this dates Seneca for you, of course. He was in the first century A.D., about the middle of the century. Now, number five, departure from Paris. Calvin became active in Paris in speaking to different Christian groups and explaining, discussing the scripture, and soon he found himself in danger of those who were trying to root out Protestantism. An event occurred at this time, which, again, we do not know the full story of, and writers take different views. There was a man named Cop, Professor Cop, C-O-P, who was elected rector of the University of Paris. The custom at that time in Paris evidently was the same as the custom when I was at the University of Berlin, that from among the distinguished members of the faculty, an outstanding man was elected rector of the university each year, and he served for 1 year. And I happened to be at Berlin just as the Nazi movement was beginning in Germany, and there was beginning to be upheaval and turmoil among the students on account of it, and the result was that the rector that year, my second year there, instead of being purely a ceremonial office, as so often was, he had to take a part in trying to keep peace and order in the university. And he was Professor Deitzmann that year, the noted New Testament scholar, and it was quite out of line with his ordinary activity to be out there trying to quiet the students and trying to administer affairs. The general administration was under a group of permanent officials, but the rector was elected for 1 year and to quite an extent a ceremonial office, except in times of special emergency. And so Professor Kopp was elected the rector for this year, and he gave an address in which he very strongly presented salvation by faith, justification by faith, the importance of the scripture, and called upon people to stand for this and spoke out strongly against the opposition to it. And the story has often been given that Calvin actually wrote the address that the rector gave. Well, it's pretty hard to prove that this isn't whether he did or didn't. In fact, you have to talk to Calvin and Topp, both of them, personally, to know whether Topp did this entirely on his own, whether he was greatly influenced with conversations with his friend Calvin, or whether Calvin actually wrote most of it. But at any rate, the Topp was so criticized for it, he had to flee for his life from Paris, and the police came to Calvin's quarters to arrest him. But Calvin had been given warning, and he also fled from Paris. And so his departure was rather precipitate from Paris. Yes? This was in November 1533. November 1533, when Calvin was 24 years of age. Yes? The University of Paris, yes. It's also called the Sorbonne. Yes. Yes, it's also called the S-O-R-B-O-N-N-E. But I believe the official name is the University of Paris. It's one of the oldest universities in Europe. Now, number six. Number six we'll call Cyclopenexia. That's capital P-S-Y, capital P-S-Y-C-H-O-P-A-N-N-Y-C-H-I-A. Spelled again, capital P-S-Y-C-H-O-P-A-N-N-Y-C-H-I-A. Or if you want to just put it in English, soul sleep. This was a work which Calvin wrote shortly after he left Paris, a work against the theory that some were widely spreading at that time, that the soul at death goes into an unconscious state and remains in it until the return of Christ. And Calvin wrote this work to refute that unbiblical idea, which is held by church sects today. That idea of soul sleep between death and the resurrection. Paul said to depart is to be with Christ, which is far better. And that verse alone would seem to be a rather complete refutation of this idea. But this was his first religious writing, was this Cyclopenexia. Number seven, his next writing, The Institute of the Christian Religion. The Institute of the Christian Religion. This was published in March 1536. We already spoke of it at our last meeting. How this was, the immediate occasion of it was a letter to King Francis I of France, who was trying to oppose the emperor, Charles V, who was wanting to destroy Lutheranism, and therefore he was wanting to support the people who he thought were against the emperor, and at the same time he wanted to persecute Protestants in Paris, in France. And so Francis had said that these Lutherans in Germany were upstanding people who were opposing the emperor on proper grounds, but that the Protestants in France were anarchists and people who were trying to destroy all good order and decency. And Calvin wrote this open letter to the king saying that this was a complete misunderstanding. In order to show what the facts were, he wanted to set forth what the French Protestants believed. And so he wrote this work, The Institute of the Christian Religion. He wrote it largely in Basel, a city in German Switzerland. And this work, The Institute of the Christian Religion, which he wrote originally in Latin, and then wrote a translation in French, was read all over Europe, and various Protestant leaders felt that it was one of the finest presentations of Christian belief that had yet been written. It was not like Luther's work dealing with one particular point or dealing with the immediate crisis and trying to deal with those issues which were right in the public eye then, but it was trying to cover the whole field of what the Protestants believed, what they felt was the biblical teaching, what was the vital center of the Christian religion. Yes, sir? some independent study of the scripture and the writings of various theologians, and he read the ancient fathers. Actually, education is an opportunity. It is not something that is poured into us like you pour something out of a bottle into someone. It is an opportunity to read, to study, to listen, to discussion, but it is what we do rather than what someone else does that constitutes education. I've known people who've had very little formal education who are much better educated than some who've had a high degree. So as a matter of fact, that is quite rare, because ordinarily a self-educated person, while they know a great deal about certain areas, there'll be big gaps in their knowledge. And usually it's not so well balanced as if they've had more direction. But in Calvin's case, he had had a great deal of formal education from the best teachers of the day in humanities, in classics, and in law. And he took this mind trained in the legal, logical way of looking at things, and trained in the careful study of words from the humanistic study, and he went to the reading of the scripture and of the fathers, and of the great Christian writers of early times and the great Christian writers of his day. And he also had much communication with Protestant leaders in Paris. But I do not know of any actual courses in theology that he ever took. Yes?
Don't we have to admit that these men, Calvin, the Muslim movement, that there's a certain amount of genius in the man,
We had a student from a distant country here a few years ago who felt very badly because we could not give him a master's degree without 2 or 3 years of hard work. He said he'd already had seminary work, he ought to have a master's degree immediately. He said, after all, he was 22 and John Calvin had a doctorate when he was 23. So eventually this fellow left us, and eventually he bought a doctorate from a degree mill, which, if one doesn't want to work for one, is perhaps the best way to get it. But actually, as Mr. Camilleri points out, to compare ourselves with the great geniuses like Luther and Calvin is rather ridiculous, because they were two of the most able men in all history. There's no question of that. But yet, they were not men who simply got along on native ability. They both were very hard workers. They took the ability God gave them, and they developed it, and they used it to the utmost. But Luther was an all-round genius. He certainly, of the dozen men in the world's history who've given evidence of being remarkable geniuses in many lines, Luther would certainly be one. Calvin, certainly as a student, as a scholar, as a man with a tremendous memory, a tremendous ability of putting things together and seeing the logical result of them, he certainly towers above most men of his day, probably most men in history. They too were outstanding men of outstanding ability, but also extremely hard workers. And Calvin could get from his own study, but I say anybody, what they learn is their own study primarily. An education is merely a help. It is not something that is given you, but it is helping you to get something. But the Institute were a great work of genius at this early age, when he was only 26, to write a work which was such a wonderful, balanced presentation. Now, the Institutes in their present form are probably 3 times as long as the original Institutes, and he worked over them all his life. He got out many new editions of them, both in Latin and in French, and his Latin style was recognized as among the finest of Latin writers of his day. Of course, not quite an Erasmus class, who, when it comes to Latin, was perhaps the greatest writer of Latin since the days of Virgil. But certainly Calvin was among the 2 or 3 finest writers of Latin in his day, and his French style had a tremendous influence on the development of the French language. Not quite as great as Luther's on German, because he did not make a translation of the Bible. Luther's translation had tremendous influence. But Luther's other works also had great influence, and Calvin's French writing Their style is recognized by even by irreligious students of French literature as having a great place in the development of the French language. But the Institute, he published in both languages, and he kept revising them all his life and got out several editions of them. Number 8, his trip to Italy and France. He'd been in Basel and Switzerland there. He went down to Italy and stayed for some months at the home of a countess there who was giving shelter to Protestant leaders and engaged in discussions there and spent time in writing. He went up to France and in disguise there he held meetings in different places. And then he decided to go to Strasbourg. Strasbourg, a city which was a great imperial city, one of the free cities of the empire. The city of Strasbourg, a city right on the border between France and Germany. It was then in Germany. Since that time, it has oscillated between France and Germany, depending which side won a war. They always see Strasbourg, and it thus was sometimes German, sometimes French. The population, mostly German, in that particular area. Incidentally, Strasbourg is the leading city in Alsace. And Alsace-Lorraine, we often speak up together. But Alsace is overwhelmingly German. Lorraine is overwhelmingly French. But the two make one economic unit. You can't very decently divide it. So the result is that each nation has a good claim to Alsace-Lorraine, because actually Alsace belongs with Germany and Lorraine with France, but you can't divide them, and the result is that they have gone back and forth several times between the two. And so, in Alsace, this great city of Strasbourg had been a Protestant city since very early in the Reformation. And Calvin decided to go to Strasbourg and there to devote himself to writing and to study, but there was a war which made it impossible to go directly. And so he had to go by an indirect route, in the course of which he went through Geneva. And so it came about that in July 1536 he went to Geneva. And so number 9 is call to Geneva. The call to Geneva. Now this we discussed last time. We noticed there how Pharaoh talked to Calvin and how he declared God's judgment would be upon Calvin if he did not help him in the work there, and how Calvin took it as the call of God to him to devote himself to helping Pharaoh in trying to make a great Reformation center in Geneva. So capital E will be Calvin's first period in Geneva. Calvin's first period in Geneva. Now, we could spend 2 or 3 days on these 2 years he was there, because he was involved in many vital activities in those 2 years. But these activities all were simply the beginning of what developed later in his later time there, and I will not at this time pause over them, merely to touch briefly on a few of the general aspects of this period of nearly 2 years. In July, there he decided to accept Pharaoh's call as the call of God and simply became an assistant to Pharaoh with practically no salary, just a bare subsistence mentioned in the records of the city council, simply as a young Frenchman who was to assist Pharaoh. But he and Pharaoh set to work energetically to try to do 2 things. To try to make Geneva a thoroughly Christian city, and to try to strengthen Geneva so that it could be a lamp to all of Europe, the center from which the gospel could go forth to all of Europe. And so with these 2 desires in mind, they spend a great deal of time planning their sermons, their catechetical classes, their discussions, their meetings with various groups to discuss Christian truth. But they did not feel their time was wasted when the city council asked them to assist in civic matters. And the civic council asked them to give its advice on treaties with Bern and other cities, and to advise on improving the laws on certain points, and wanted to take advantage of their ability and their training in these laws. And they didn't feel it was wasted because they had a great ideal for the importance that they felt that Geneva should have. The city had voted, the council had voted, that it was to become a Protestant city. The Reformed faith was to be the center of the life of the city, but there were many in the city to whom that did not mean much. There were some priests still in the city who were meeting privately with people and trying to urge them to get a change in this, and the great bulk of the people were simply interested in pleasure and frivolity and not anxious to be in any kind of serious religious life. And so they had a hard task at which they worked very solidly, but also they had to help in the relation with other cities around. And I described to you last time how the city of Lausanne, the nearest important city, it's on the same lake that Geneva's on, but further east on the northern shore of Lake Geneva, there was a discussion in Lausanne as which was considering whether to become a Protestant city, and Farrell went to participate in the discussion. And I mentioned to you how Calvin went, and how their Calvin's great knowledge of the early Christian writers came out, how he simply by heart could quote and tell where the passage was in relation to other passages that the Romanist leaders quoted. Yes? L-A-U-S-A-N-N-E. L-A-U-S-A-N-N-E. That's gone. And so this discussion brought Calvin into prominence, and they began soon, instead of talking of Farrell and Calvin, to talk about Calvin and Farrell. And of course, Farrell was 20 years older than Calvin was. He was the man who had started the Reformation in Geneva. If he'd been, and like many people are, he would have become jealous of Calvin's prominence, but Farrell seems to have been interested solely in accomplishing for the Lord. And there's no evidence, at least, that he felt the least bit sorry of the fact that Calvin was beginning to get more attention than he was. Yes? He said, I said that it was in July 1536 that he was called there, and I have not yet mentioned the specific date, that it was in April 1538 when they were back. We mentioned last time how they had been free, or been able to maintain their freedom from the powers that had previously held them through the intervention of the city of Bern, which had come to the relief, with their armies, the relief of Geneva. And now they wanted to have a treaty with Bern to continue for considerable time to give them assurance that it would protect them. And they were indeed wise in looking out for protection, because in this world of wickedness, there's always a danger if one does not keep up this protection. It's interesting to note that as much as 50 years after the death of Calvin, one night, the people who at this time had tried to hold Geneva in subjection, one night, more than 50 years after Calvin's death, they came up to the walls of the city and sneaked up there in the dark with ladders and then tried to climb over the wall and to capture the city, and a number of them got in. It was only after considerable fighting that they were dislodged. And so it was very important that they have the help of Bern and other cities. And the Bernese felt that it was through their insistence that Farrell had been allowed to preach there in the first place. They had said, if we're going to be allied with you, you must at least give the Reformed faith that we hold a hearing. And they had allowed Farrell to come and preach, and they had found that the degenerate and corrupt Romanist leaders who were there at that time simply couldn't hold their own argument with Farrell. and they had decided to throw them off. Well, now the Berenice, they needed the Berenice protection. And the representative Baron said, let's have a unity in religious observances. We have certain ceremonies, certain ways of conducting our religious services, and yours are rather different. Why don't you follow up? And the city council said, all right, we will. So they notified Calvin Farrell, change your service to fit with it. Now, Calvin saw nothing wrong with the Bernese service. Nothing at all wrong with them. It was to him a rather indifferent matter as between the order of the Genevan services and the order of the Bernese services. But Calvin felt that it was particularly since the city of Geneva did control everything within the city, and it was the city officials who decided to make it a Protestant city rather than a Roman city, he felt it was very important that there be an area in which it be recognized that the church's authority was supreme and the city had no right to compel the church. He had already at this early time in his life thought through that problem, which Luther refused ever to think through, and as a result of which, all the Lutheran areas for the next 2 or 3 centuries were almost under almost absolute control of the state. Calvin said, the church must decide on its services. We will not simply take orders from the state as to the conduct of our church. And the council then said, we've been having a lot of trouble with these obstreperous preachers anyway. They said, we give you 4 days to bring your services in line. So Sunday was within those 4 days, and they carried on their services the way they'd been before. And then the council said, we give you 24 hours to get out of town. And so Calvin and Farrell were driven out. They got 2 other good Protestant men to conduct the services. They wanted it to be a Protestant city, but they wanted to be sure they had the protection of Baron, and they didn't like these obstreperous preachers starting to tell them how the services would be held. And so Calvin and Farrell shook the dust of the city off their feet, and Farrell felt very, very badly about it. He had had great hope for developing a great center here. Calvin, however, felt we did the best we could under the circumstances, and we had been driven out. Now we can feel we did what we can here. Now we can go and do whatever the Lord calls us to next. And so Farrell was very soon called to another Swiss city, Neuchâtel, which is maybe 100 miles, I don't know just how far, in a somewhat northerly direction from Geneva. It was a much smaller city, but he stayed there for the next 40 years, and he did a very fine work there in Neuchâtel. But Calvin went to Strasbourg, the place he had been heading for when he got stopped in Geneva. And so F is Calvin at Strasbourg, 1538 to 1541. And Calvin felt that the happiest days of his life were these 2.5 years which he spent at Strasbourg. Number one there, the call from Butzer. The call from Butzer, capital B-U-C-E-R. Now this man, Butzer, is one of the secondary leaders of the Reformation. That is to say, if you name about five or six men who are the great reformers of the 16th century, then if you name 10 men who are in the next line of the great leaders of Protestant, he would certainly be in those 10. He was a great Christian leader, but not one of the top ones. But he was important in a number of different connections. And so we mentioned especially here how he was converted. I mentioned before how he came to Protestantism when they first tried to quiet Luther. They gave orders that the Augustinian order should have a meeting in Germany at which Luther would be silent. This was in 1518. And when Luther went down to Heidelberg to this meeting of the Augustinian order, he preached quite a little in the town, and they had public meetings and discussions. They wanted to know, what is the truth of this? Is Luther right? Is he wrong? Should he be silent? They did not yet feel the danger that they must shut him up by all means. They gave him quite a bit of opportunity to speak, and Bucer was a Dominican monk, the order to which Tetzel belonged. But Bucer heard Luther then and decided he was right, and left Romanism and became an important Protestant leader in 1518. Now, Bucer had come to Strasbourg and become the leader of the Reformation in Strasbourg. Later, he had a great part in the Reformation in England. One man could have in those days in various countries more easily than today, because all educated people could speak Latin in those days. So an educated person could have an influence in any country of Europe in those days. But Bucer said to Calvin, he had read Calvin's Institutes, he was very glad to have Calvin there. Calvin had visited Strasbourg once before as a young man, had become acquainted with Bucer. Bucer said, the persecution is quite severe in France. And there are dozens of people who have fled for their lives to Strasbourg. And he said, our services are held in Germany, and these people don't understand it. And so they are trying to have their own separate meeting in which they speak French, but they have no proper leader. Now, would you take the leadership of these French refugees in Strasbourg? And so Calvin undertook that. So number two, he called it the Little Church. The Little Church. It was a little French church in a German city. But this church was made up of people who had fled for their lives because of their belief in the Reformation teaching. And so Calvin had a marvelous opportunity there with people of this type to develop the church in line with what he thought the Bible taught, without the kind of opposition and difficulty that would come from the sort of people that so many were in Geneva, who were simply luxury-loving, pleasure-seeking people who looked for a protection from the tyranny of their former leaders, and therefore had welcomed their Protestants coming into the city. And so Calvin worked out an order of service in French for the city, for the French people there. He wrote some hymns for them in French. And he planned the control of the church, not simply under his direction, but with representatives of the people meeting with him and discussing the situations and deciding on the progress of the church. And he felt these 2.5 years were among the happiest of his life. Number three, his marriage. In 1540 there, he married a widow in Strasbourg there. They lived together very happily until 1549, when she died. But they had 9 happy years together. They had a child born in 1542, but the child only lived a few months, to Calvin's great sorrow. Number four, his meeting with Melanchthon. This was an unexpected thing, a cause of great happiness to him, was that in 3 times, during this period, there were important meetings between Romanists and Protestants in which Melanchthon was the leading Protestant representative, and Calvin attended these meetings. They were either in Strasbourg or in other cities that could be reached from Strasbourg, and in the last of them, Calvin, along with Melanchthon, were 2 of the leaders representing the Protestants. And there he made his great acquaintance, his friendship with Melanchthon, that lasted the rest of their lives. And so Melanchthon was Luther's closest friend, and he was one of Calvin's very best friends. Number five, the letter of Cardinal Sadolet and Calvin's reply. Sadolet, S-A-D-O-L-E-T. The letter of Cardinal Sadolet and Calvin's reply. Now this is something that happened not affecting Strasbourg directly at all. It was in relation to Geneva. Cardinal Sadolet was the very finest type of a Romanist leader. That is to say, he was a man who had who was outstanding, against whose character it would be difficult to find causes of public criticism, who had an attitude of looking at facts, investigating things reasonably, being kindly in most relationships. And he had been a secretary of Pope Leo X, He was now a bishop. He had often been in diplomatic peace negotiations between the Pope, the King of France, and the Emperor of Germany. Had a high reputation as a scholar, a poet, a gentleman of irreproachable character and devout piety. And he wrote a letter to the people of Geneva, an open letter, in which he begged the people of Geneva to come back to the Roman Church. And he put forth his arguments in a very, very skillful way. The only thing that is a little different from what you might expect from the fine things that all was said about him was the way he talked about some of the Protestant leaders. He said, these men are simply trying to make money off you. They're trying to get fame and money and so on. It's for their own advantage entirely that they've been leading you into these ideas. Yes? No. No, he wrote this to the people. He was a bishop of an area in southern France, and he wrote this to the people of Geneva, urging them to come back to the Roman Catholic Church. And this letter was so well written, so beautifully written, and sounded so very reasonable and logical, as that the leaders at Geneva just didn't know how to answer. The leaders of Geneva were anxious that the city remain Protestant. They didn't want to get back under the tyranny of the bishops again. Some of them were doubtless very sincere, earnest Protestants. Others of them felt that for political reasons it was much safer for them to stay Protestant rather than risk coming back under the control of their former tyrants. They knew the only way they could keep their freedom was to have the support of the armies of Bern and these other Protestant cities in northern Switzerland in case of crisis or emergency. Among the people, there were those who were opposing them, and these people who felt that way were taking this letter and saying, look at this letter. Why on earth should we leave the great church to which our ancestors belonged for hundreds of years for these Protestant men who are just trying to make money off us and get fame and advantages for themselves? And so the leaders of the Council of Geneva looked around for advice on how to answer the letter. And were wondering how to deal with it the best way. And somebody said, you remember that young Frenchman that was here for 2.5 years before we kicked him out of the city? They said he had a marvelous style, a quick way of assessing situations, a brilliant way of dealing with arguments. And they said, this idea that the Protestants are just looking for advantage for themselves, you remember he'd given practically nothing while he was here. With self-sacrifice, he devoted himself to what he believed in, and now up in Strasbourg, he's got a little group of refugees that he's ministering to, and he's working his head off and getting practically nothing for it. They said, why not ask him to write an answer for us to Bishop Sadler? And so they sent a representative up to see Calvin with a copy of Sadler's letter. And they said, we would be very grateful if you would write an answer, suggested answer that we might send to Cardinal Sadler. That would be published, of course, and would help to show our people we should stay Protestant. Well, Calvin got busy on writing the letter, and what he wrote was truly a master. And he answered the religious arguments of Sadolet's letter in a kindly, friendly, logical, reasonable way, and yet so skillfully and so logically that there was just practically nothing he could say in answer to the arguments he gave. And he took up his statements about the character of the Protestant leaders, and he showed how different was the small stipend most of the Protestant leaders were getting with the great sums of money and prestige that the Roman leaders had been having for such a long time. And he showed the self-sacrifice of the Protestant leaders. He dealt with the different points, one after another, that Sadolet took up. And he did it in such a way that people who were uncertain were, most of them, convinced by his letter. And so they sent the letter to Sadolet, but the council in Geneva had it printed. They had Sadolet's letter and Calvin's letter printed together in a little pamphlet. And the people of Geneva, those who had been uncertain, were swung to the side of the Reformation, or at least were unable to answer the argument. And the letter was sent, copies were sent all over Europe, and people said, this is truly a masterpiece. And so, the Geneva was saved for the Reformation. And, naturally, this led to number 8. Calvin, Geneva requests Calvin to return, September 1540. So in September 1540, they sent a letter to Calvin and said, will you please come back to Geneva and become our chief minister? And Calvin said, I'd rather die 100 deaths than go back to Geneva. He said, I have all I ever want to see of that place. And so they said, well, now we've got to get Calvin back. It took them a year to get him back. They got busy planning how they could give him better provisions for working than he had before, assure him that he wouldn't be treated the way he was before and kicked out again. They were just so anxious to get Calvin back, and they got in touch with other Protestant leaders to try to help them. And Farrell wrote a letter to Calvin, urging Calvin to go back. They didn't ask Farrell to come back. They wouldn't have asked either of them, except for the way Calvin had answered his letter to Sadler. But that had made such an impression, they felt the need of Calvin back. And so eventually they sent a large delegation representing all parties in Geneva. They sent a delegation to urge Calvin to come back and to take the leadership of the religious activities of Geneva. And Calvin agreed to do it and came back to Geneva. And his first Sunday preached on the next verse in the series after the last one he preached on 2.5 years before, just before he left. And so that leads us on to Geneva of 1541 to 1547. 1541 to 1547. It was September 1541 when Calvin came back to Geneva. And now Calvin was extremely anxious that he shouldn't simply go back to simply to preach sermons and to have an influence on a few people, but to make Geneva a center from which the light of the gospel would go forth into all of Europe. And the transformation that Calvin made in Geneva is something that is hard to duplicate anywhere in the history of the world. Because this city, which had been a light-hearted, frivolous center of travel on the main commercial line between France and Italy, where the people were light-hearted and frivolous, and there was very little serious interest, became a city which was recognized even by those who did not agree with Calvin's religious ideas as a city of as high morality and ethics and of as great a religious center as there was anywhere in the world. It became what Luther was hoping Wittenberg would become. But Wittenberg never did become. Calvin, Luther, 2 years before his death, left Wittenberg in disgust because of the fact that Wittenberg, while greatly influenced by Luther's teaching, did not have the wholesale change in it that was made in Geneva. But the making of it was a hard task which occupied Calvin for the next 25 years. And he worked day and night during those years. He met tremendous opposition and difficulties. He had terrible struggles he went through until finally he had was completely victorious. It was against very great odds and very great obstacles. And during this time, he was constantly trying to improve the religious life of the city, took an interest in every phase of that. He was trying to increase the knowledge of people of the Bible, their understanding of religious truth, and so he preached on at least 9/10 of the chapters of the Bible in the time he was there. He preached every day, twice on Sunday. And he had meetings of the clergy of Geneva and the surrounding district every week in which they discussed things together and tried for mutual improvement. He studied improving the government of the church. its effect on the lives of everyone, not just the presentation of the truth. He worked in all these things, but he also was working in trying to make Geneva a city that could become a real center. And so for this purpose, before he'd been there many years, he decided the city must have a stronger economic base. And he looked about for a means of giving it that. And he decided on the introduction of the silk industry into Geneva. And so through his efforts, the silk industry was brought into Geneva, which resulted in doubling the economic situation of the city and giving it a stability and an economic position that was very important in it being the center that he wanted to be. Before he'd been there long, there were great numbers of French refugees fleeing from the persecution coming to Geneva. Now he came into difficulty with the people of Geneva, the old families who said, Geneva for the Geneva. Our ancestors lived here for years. What do we want these newcomers from France? And for 10 years, he couldn't get them to make any of them citizens. Calvin had no vote himself for 10 years after he was there. They were simply outsiders. They were guests in the place. And not very well-received guests on the whole. But he managed in the end to get that change so that they got their citizenship and got their power in the city. He eventually got a college started there, which became a fine center for Christian training. When he died, there was found on his table a plan for an improvement in the arrangement of the guards around the walls of the city. It shows how even in his last minutes, he was thinking, how can we make the city stronger and safer, a greater center? Some people have said that when you look at Luther standing before the emperor, Luther in these great world-shaking affairs he was mixed up in, and Calvin struggles in Geneva, they were a tempest in a teapot, little tiny thing compared to the big things Luther was in. Well, they seemed so in a way, but they were tremendously important because they were making the center from which the message could go forth. And the result was that when in England the great time of persecution came, great numbers of refugees came to Geneva and studied there with Calvin. And one of these was John Knox, who preached to the English refugees in here, and who, though he was much older than Calvin, looked to Calvin as his leader and went back and led the Great Reformation in Scotland. Well, we look on from there tomorrow.